evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, April 28, 2015. Some members of the South Sudanese diaspora here in Washington, D.C. denounce the policies of President Salva Kiir. And officials teach life-saving skills to South Sudanese youth so they can concentrate on helping their families and forget about fighting.
When we talk about peace, we are saying that let us try to forgive each other. So when somebody boxes you, I will go to teacher. And the teacher, somebody have taken my pen by force, so I don't want to fight. So it means that I want peace to be between us.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. These were members of the South Sudanese diaspora chanting that slogan in front of the White House. Our web editor Karen Zaifogo was right there. Karen, what happened?
Well, there were about 20 South Sudanese who turned up for the demonstration, and many of them, like Mary Gutluak from Upper Nile, told me that they have lost family in the conflict in South Sudan. Gutluak came to Lafayette Square opposite the White House with a simple message. She wants the United States to pressure President Kiir to step down. Says, we come today to let America know we really need help. We need peace. We need the suffering to end. I pointed out to her that the United States has already given $1 billion in aid to South Sudan since December 2013. Gutluak said she is aware of the generosity of the U.S. government and the American people, but she says the money alone will not help. We need America to stop the killing. And one thing she said that needs to be done is for Uganda to pull its troops out of South Sudan. She said, we want Uganda to go away. We want to tell this to the world, and we want Salva Kiir to go. Manyang Torogang has a similar message.
My name is Manyang Torogang.
She says she wants South Sudan to stay united, but she called on the international community to bring pressure on Mr. Kiir to step down. I asked what should happen if he does agree to go, and Manyang said the country should hold elections and choose a new leader. The leader of the demonstration...
Yes, I'm Reyes Moy Tang. I'm the representative for the SPLM opposition here in the United States.
Says the protesters have yet another demand of the U.S. government.
We would like also to have the U.S. government to lead from the front, and we have President Obama to declare Salva Kiir an illegitimate president.
And there were also calls for more sanctions to be imposed on South Sudan's leaders.
We support sanctions in South Sudan.
So that was basically it. The demonstration was still in full swing when I left to come back here to the studio, and I do intend to go back and see what's happening.
All right, thank you, Karen. South Sudan's Ministries of Education, Culture, Youth and Sports teamed up with UNICEF today to showcase progress made towards implementing their peace-building initiative. Officials say teaching skills like carpentry, farming and fishing is helpful to young people who are not attending school in the country. Philip Thonaleu has this story for VOA from Juba.
Students of Juba Gudele East Primary School sing a song which ends with the message that South Sudanese should not be known as a group of tribes, but as one nation. Officials believe one way to help build peace is through education. Irenes Aware, a primary six student of Gudele West School, says peaceful coexistence begins in the classroom.
When we talk about peace, we are saying that let us try to forgive each other. So when somebody box you, it's not mean that this you immediately you fight. But I will go to teacher. and to teach somebody have taken my pen by force, so I don't want to fight. So it means that I want peace to be between us.
Aware is one of many students throughout the country who has taken part in the peace building, education, and advocacy program targeting children, adolescents, and youth in the poor socio-economic states of Western Equatoria, Central Equatoria, Wharf, and Western Bahr el-Ghazal. Participants are taught life skills such as changing old behaviors, improving interactions between children from different ethnic groups, and hands-on job training. Otto James Avelino is education coordinator with World Child Canada, one of many non-governmental organizations helping the government to implement the program. Avelino, whose organization operates in Upper Nile and Eastern Equatorial States, says the youth activities like traditional dance and football to foster peace between different tribal communities, and he says it is working.
They're able to share books, they're able to visit each other, despite they are from different ethnic backgrounds. So that means a functional literacy, in a way, is trying to harmonize, is trying to bring together people from diverse cultures, diverse background, to be one in terms of learning.
Avelino says youth are taught how to manage stress and minimize violence, while many others are taught of vocation such as farming and fishing.
If such category of people can come together and do economic activities together, it shows peace. Therefore, they very much call for peace to be able to invest more in economic activities and invite more youth to do the same.
Avelino says, despite the great desire for peace expressed by the people at the grassroots level, only 600 people have been able to take part in its programs. He says the 16-month-old conflict has slowed down his peace-building efforts in Upper Nile State, especially in the Wau Chulu community. William Mater, an advisor to the Ministry of Education, agrees.
We need a peaceful environment because the environment for learning is paramount. And if we look around, with all initiatives that have been done, we realize that parts of our beloved country are witnessing disasters.
Atter says the government is committed to giving children a chance to learn and to live peacefully with one another. So far, only children and young people in the poor previously mentioned states have been able to participate in the project. Ajok Malwal, a 13-year-old student at Gudele West Primary School, says she has learned that fighting another student in school or at home is wrong. She says even if another student pushes her in anger, she will try to find a way to settle the dispute amicably.
So I want that to happen. But many people cannot do that. Some people, they just like themselves, like they come and fight, and that is not good. And we need peace in South Sudan.
Ajok says many children and youth in South Sudan have a strong desire for peace. But it remains to be seen whether programs like this one will create safe environments for South Sudanese to live and work and to learn to build their country together. For BOA News, I am Philip Thonaleu in Juba.
South Sudanese author Philip, I beg your pardon. South Sudanese author Victor Lugala has written books about civil war that rocked once United Sudan for more than two decades and eventually led to the creation of South Sudan. Waki Simon Wudu spoke with Lugala and filed this report from Juba.
Lugala's three fiction books, Pot of Tears, Beating Drums of War, and Vomiting the Stolen Foot, highlight the intense suffering many South Sudanese endured throughout the most recent civil war.
It is just a traumatic experience because I was talking about what happened during that period, how people were killed. People went through a lot of suffering, and I had to relive some of these things because I conceived the idea when I was in Khartoum in the early 90s.
Southern Sudanese rose up against Khartoum to fight against marginalization, oppression, and attempts to Islamize them. More than 2 million people died during the two-decade-long conflict, and an estimated 4 million were displaced. Lugala lived through the war. Now in his 40s, Lugala is part of a new breed of South Sudanese intellectuals trying to document South Sudan's history for future generations.
The idea was that this is our history that we should not forget, because some of the children who are born maybe after or during the war might have not really known what happened to their fathers, to their uncles, to their mothers. So this is like documenting what happened.
Lugala says more people need to follow in his footsteps and tell their versions of South Sudan's story. But for that to happen, South Sudan needs to invest in education, he says. Under Khartoum's rule, many Southern Sudanese were denied the right to education. They were also too busy trying to survive to focus on developing a literary tradition and infrastructure. As a result, Lugala says,
we don't have publishing houses in South Sudan. We have a few printers here and there, but that is not enough. The second thing is that if you want to get your material published, it really has to meet the requirements of that particular publishing house. Some of the stories that some of us have published outside the country appear in anthologies that are published by big companies. But as an individual, it becomes very, very difficult for you to look for a publisher, because sometimes they look at the material and they look at the market, because if your story doesn't really fit into what they want or whether it will sell or not, then they will not use it.
The South Sudan Writers Association, an organization which attempts to boost the efforts of South Sudanese authors and promote the culture of writing, agrees with the Lugala. Victor Kerry, the Secretary General of the association, says would-be South Sudanese writers face challenges that go far beyond pen and paper or the printing of books and magazines.
We need to be computer literate because these days, if you know how to operate computer, you can, you know, do a great lot of works on writing. And also financially, South Sudanese writers are not well off, and they need to be assisted, or at least their works to be published, and this can finance them to do other works. You need space and a very conducive environment for writing.
Kerry says that because the majority of South Sudanese cannot read and write, Lugala work only has a small audience inside the country. Kerry says most South Sudanese authors write books that focus on politics. He says they need to find new, more unifying themes.
They should write about problems affecting women, problems affecting children, problems affecting, you know, the gender inequality in our society, the early marriage of our young children, our young daughters, and they need to encourage girls to get education just like their brothers. We can see that we need to have good roads. We need to have good hospitals. We need to have good schools. We need to have to enter agriculture and be, you know, self-sufficient in food.
Lugala says that whatever he writes about in future, his main goal is to see South Sudan's literary culture flourish.
I just want to appeal to people who are writing or who plan to write. They should start writing, because we have very, very few writers, very few people who have been published. That's why some of us are self-published. So we really need, there is a lot of potential in this country, how young it may be. There's a lot of potential in terms of literature. We have so many people who write even better than me, but those stories need to be brought out to the public.
Lugala writes in English. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Officials in Western Bahr al-Ghazal state try to combat the spread of malaria by distributing 1 million bed nets. That story is coming up.
On Thursday, April 30th, VOA hosts a town hall-style meeting to discuss the South Sudan peace process. Moderator John Tanza and VOA's panel of guests will discuss what has been the role of the media, the involvement of the international community, how the peace process was conducted, and has it been inclusive enough? Join us for this event live on April 30th from 1800 to 1930 UTC by visiting voanews.com/South Sudan and clicking on the live web link. We welcome your participation with comments and questions. Email us at southsudan@voanews.com or you can tweet at VOA South Sudan. What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what was your worst subject in school and why?
Oh my God, I think going back to anything to do with science subjects, those were my worst, and yet well passed, but those were my worst.
My worst subject in school was mathematics. It was hard for me to understand, and the calculation takes a lot of thinking. It's not that easy.
My worst subject was agriculture. I don't know why I was hating it, but I just feel like agriculture wasn't on my side.
Well, I didn't like mathematics because maybe I guess I was biased, and it was really hard, and the teachers were always very tough. They would always focus on those who know how to calculate.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. It's time for our Tuesday health segment. Today we are talking about malaria. Health officials in Western Bahr el Ghazal state are distributing 1 million new bed nets to help protect residents against malaria as global concerns rise about the growing resistance to anti-malaria drugs. Officials say residents also need more education about the importance of bed nets, which are often used for other things. For VOA, Dimo Silva Auralio reports from WOW.
Abdelgadir Madwok, the state malaria control director, says malaria patients have become more resistant to drugs because they skip regular doses. He says people often buy painkillers when they feel the first symptoms rather than being seen by a doctor because the health center is too far away. Or if they do see a doctor and get anti-malarial drugs, they often share them with others who have no access to doctors. But health experts say the biggest problem is that most people don't regularly sleep under mosquito bed nets. Speaking in Arabic, Abdelgadir says that's got to change.
As of May and June, we are going to distribute bed nets to everybody without discrimination. We expect to distribute 1 million bed nets. That will cover the state as a whole, God willing.
State health officials distributed 60,000 bed nets in 2014, especially to pregnant mothers and those living near stagnant water. Still, more than 31,000 people in Western Bahr el Ghazal contracted malaria last year. Abdelgadir says another big problem is improper use of bed nets. According to a survey conducted in 2013, by Western Bahr el Ghazal's State Malaria Control Department, most people don't sleep under bed nets. In his state, Abdelgadir says the survey found the nets are being used for fencing in crops or netting fish.
This survey assesses the availability of bed nets per household, and we found that bed nets are used for covering mango plants and fishing by the riverside.
In a tragic irony, many Western Bahr el Ghazal residents who succumb to malaria are covered in the bed nets before being buried. This practice has also discouraged people from sleeping under bed nets because the nets themselves have become associated with death. 20-year-old Linda John has been admitted twice to a hospital for malaria, but says she chooses not to sleep under a net because she believes the myth about nets being linked to death.
I will never sleep happily under a mosquito net. I feel as if I am in the cemetery, just like a dead person.
On the other hand, 30-year-old Santa Peter, a mother of four, says sleeping under bed net is a family obligation, especially since her children continue to suffer on and off from malaria.
I don't know what is the main reason, as we are usually sleeping under mosquito net. Last year, I take them to the hospital about 3 to 4 times. Even one child may get sick 2 to 3 times.
But Peter says he realizes this doesn't mean mosquito nets are ineffective. Peter says he also uses a mosquito repellent as an added safeguard against malaria when her children play around the compound before going to bed.
What I discovered is that before we go to sleep, then when we are outside at 6 to 7 p.m., at this time, maybe the mosquito will bite. That's where children may get affected with the malaria. When I discovered this, I tried to buy the mosquito repellents. They have to smell with the mosquito repellent before they went to sleep.
On World Malaria Day last Saturday, the World Health Organization warned that despite dramatic declines in malaria cases and deaths since 2000, more than 500,000 lives are still lost each year to this preventable disease. The UN estimates that some 15 million pregnant women did not receive a single dose of the recommended anti-malaria drugs last year, and that an estimated 278 million people in Africa still live in households without a single insecticide-treated bed net. From January to March of this year, Western Balgazal has documented 3,000 severe malaria cases. Health officials say that number could double once the rainy begins next month. For VOA, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio, reporting in WOW.
From WOW, we move to AWIL. Employees of Medicine Sans Frontieres, or MSF, in Northern Bahr El Ghazal State have agreed to end strike over poor working conditions after state officials got involved in the dispute. As Abraham Agod reports from AWIL, workers say they are hopeful the demands that made them walk off the job last week will be met by Medicine Sans Frontieres.
Around 300 workers at the main hospital in AWIL went on a strike last week, accusing MSF of turning a blind eye to poor working conditions, including long hours and low pay. They also said they want to be paid in US dollars instead of the South Sudanese pounds, which has depreciated sharply in recent months. Northern Bahr El Ghazal State Health Minister Tongdeng Anai says his ministry was able to convince the workers to go back to work. Deng says ministry officials spoke with MSF and the medical aid charity has agreed to look into the grievances that caused the workers to go on strike in the first place. But he says the workers should not expect big changes overnight.
After all, the decision cannot be made from here. They have to go to Juba, to their head office in Juba, and their head office in Juba also cannot make a decision. They have to send it to Paris so that the final decision has to be made. And also, on top of that, it cannot be done only in AWIL. If the MSF is going to do this, they have to do it in all their site, in the project site, because then AWIL is not exceptional from the other state. So if they want to increase the salary, they have to do it for all their staff in all MSF sites in South Sudan. If they want to change the working hours, they have to change it across South Sudan. If they want to change the payment of the staff into dollars, they have to do it across South Sudan. So these are things that now MSF are looking into those possibilities.
Deng says it was regrettable that the strike happened at all and that violence fled when security forces tried to break a protest.
It's the right of the staff to go on strike if they are not happy with something, but they have to do it in a respectful way, in a way that it is understood by their employer, but not through violence.
He says there were several arrests when the strike workers prevented other hospital employees from crossing picket line and going to work.
They wanted to resume their duties, and they were not allowed by some of the staff delegates. They were just at the gate, and they were chasing away the staff by force. And those guys were arrested. We arrested them because this was not a strike. We felt that there is something behind it. A strike is something done at the individual level. People are with the willing of the people. But if there are people who want to come and work, there is no point somebody else coming and standing there to chase away the people.
Thomas Dunn is one of the strikers who was arrested. He says he does not know why he was detained.
What we did on Thursday was there was a result. Then when I found
to the hospital gate, so I was arrested by police. Definitely, we were not happy because you need to be arrested and you need to be told that you were arrested because of the reason, but we were not told the reason. I was just captured by the police and then they took me there without asking me any questions.
Victor Cage is one of the representatives of the striking workers. He says MSF has told the strikers that their complaints will be addressed this week. Akej says he is hopeful that the workers' grievances will be resolved.
Well, we were told that by MSF, during our strike, the government have intervened, and they told us that you go back to your normal working duties, and then you wait for the result on date 1 of May. It will determine either you will go on a strike again, or so we were expecting our result to be positive.
Efforts to reach MSF comment were unsuccessful. A handful of government workers have been providing essential services at the hospital in Awil during the strike. MSF is one of the main employers in Northern Barkhazali State. It has been operating in the state for 15 years. For VOA News, I'm Abraham Goth reporting in Awil.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are some of today's news headlines with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. The United States has confirmed that Iran has intercepted a commercial cargo ship in Iranian waters and is sending a ship and aircraft to observe interaction. A Pentagon spokesman says the Marshall Islands flagged ship, the Maersk Tigris, was in Iranian territorial waters when Iranian patrol vessels approached it. The Maersk was directed by Iranian officials to proceed deeper into Iranian waters, but declined, prompting one of the Iranian vessels to fire shots across its bow. National Guard troops have been deployed across the eastern U.S. city of Baltimore, Maryland, as authorities attempt to restore a day after riots broke out following the funeral of Freddie Gray. He's a 25-year-old black man who died from injuries sustained while in police custody earlier this month. Maryland's governor declared a state of emergency in Baltimore, and public schools in the city are closed today. And finally, protests continue for a third day in Burundi over the president's attempt for a third term in office. Six people are reported to have died since Sunday in clashes with police. However, a Burundian government spokesman says police strongly deny involvement in the death of any protesters. He says during such demonstrations, it is not clear who is doing the shooting. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Panda Book by Joel Nyal.
Koi dita ninga manin baya panan. We koi roya ninga manin baya panan. Yada panda ke yaka kiti. 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 Panda ka kor buki jam nele chinke de panda ka jot kunele. Panda ka kor buki jam nele chinke de panda ka jot kunele. Koi did walk, dig me the kuna pin, big a yaket. Koi rye walk, dig me the kuna pin, big a yaket. Koi did walk, dig me the kuna pin, big a yaket. Koi rye walk, dig me the kuna pin, big a yaket. Koi did walk, dig me the kuna pin, big a yaket. Koi rye walk, dig me the kuna pin, big a yaket. Koi did walk, dig me the kuna pin, big a yaket. Koi rye walk, dig me the kuna pin, big a yaket. Panaka kor buki jam nele chinke de panaka jot kunale ha panaka kor buki jam nele chinke de panaka jot kunale ha.
We have been listening to Joel Nyal with the song Panda Book. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for allowing us into your homes and vehicles. We hope you join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Chinalichara nchito and juma and chinalichara kia dukit chinalichara.